Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, November 22nd. Drake University students are on Thanksgiving break, so I'm your reader today, Mark John Conley. Now let's get started with some local headlines. Our first article today has a headline that reads, Hitchcock and Mount Crescent prescribe burns earlier this month promote prairie health. The Los Hills were thick with smoke earlier this month, but it was for good reasons. Potawatomi Conservation teamed up with other area agencies to conduct prescribed land management burns at Hitchcock Nature Center and Mount Crescent Ski Area. A series of burns were held across the 1,500-acre park system, started the week of November 6th, and wrapped up last Wednesday. Kylie Jaycott, Promotions and Outreach Coordinator with Potawatomi Conservation, said prescribed burns can take place any time of year, but they are commonly performed around November, when weather conditions are just right. Potawatomi County has since issued a burn ban, which remains in effect. It's very weather-dependent, Jaycott said. We're looking for specific temperatures, humidity levels, wind, speed, and direction, our goals as Potawatomi Conservation, and how available our various fire partners are. Jaycott gave the Nonpareil an up-close look at the work being done, as county natural resource specialists and area fire partners lit up the valleys near the Los Hills Lodge Interpretive Facility on November 15th. She said the county was joined that day by volunteers from the Council Bluffs and Woodbine Fire Departments and Nebraska's Turkey Creek Preserve and Fontenelle Forest. We have a bunch of different fire partners that work with us every year, she said. That relationship goes back and forth. They get some training and education opportunities, and we can go out and assist with the wildfires too. Matt Jones, the new Los Hills Project Director for the Nature Conservancy in Iowa, has been working prescribed burns and fire suppression efforts across the country for more than 20 years. He was part of a burn crew at Hitchcock on November 9th. He said fire partnerships, like the ones on display at the park, are critical. It's so important to expand and grow our capacity to prescribe fire, he said. It takes a lot of time, people, and resources to do these safely and effectively. Fire is a natural part of the health and restoration of prairie grassland, Jaycott said, and prescribed burns help stimulate native plant growth and increase diversity by getting rid of encroaching invasive plants. Prescribed burning, especially in the prairie where we're at, in the Los Hills, is super important, she said. Our prairie plants depend on fire in the same way that we depend on sunlight and water. That also means a reduction in fuel load, thus reducing the risk for wildfire. While conditions at Hitchcock were quite hot and smoky, depending on the time and location last Wednesday, the park was open and operating like normal. A couple and their dog hiked by as freshly ignited brush lining Fox Run Ridge blazed on. A homeschool education class got a show with their lunch as they watched plumes of smoke rise up from the hills and valleys. Many guests have been curious and interested to get an up-close look at the process, Jaycott said. We don't close during prescribed fire, she said. Part of the reason for that is because we want the public to remember that fire is a part of our natural environment, especially being in the Great Plains. Potawatomi Conservation said in a news release that Iowa was once 85% tall grass prairie, but now less than a tenth of a percent remains. Jones said this is why maintaining the ecological health of the Los Hills is so important. The Los Hills are such a unique landform, Jones said, with such little remnant prairie left in Iowa, especially western Iowa, Continuing to get fire on the ground will allow these prairies to keep thriving. Pottawatomie Conservation manages 6 public parks and 6 habitat areas across the county. The organization's work includes managing the parks, providing public and public education programming, and performing community outreach in schools and other areas. Jaycott said they try to give the public as much notice as possible before conducting prescribed burns, and updates can be found online. Guests visiting Hitchcock Nature Center can check the park's air quality in real time by visiting map.purpleair.com and searching the park's name. Our next headline reads, Mary Jones, co-founder of Solus, had a passion for animals. Mary Jones had a passion for animals, those who knew her said. Though her professional career was in the insurance field, Jones was better known for her ceaseless work in saving thousands of homeless animals. Support Our Local Animal Shelter, or SOLAS, was founded in 1993 by Mary and her husband Mike, who died in 2005. Since its inception, SOLAS has saved thousands of homeless animals' lives, said Sarah Richardson, its current president and a member for 15 years, rather. Mary was always a fierce advocate for animals that couldn't speak for themselves, Richardson said. She gave them a voice, sometimes literally by appearing in countless TV spots to showcase adoptable animals. Jones, co-founder of Solus, died Saturday in Missouri Valley. She was 76. Since the formation of the Midlands Humane Society in Council Bluffs, Solus has turned its efforts to stray or other homeless animals, providing food, care, and love until such time that a forever home can be found, Richardson said. She founded it to be the foster wing of the old Council Bluffs shelter, caring for young, injured, or ill animals that the shelter could not, Richardson said. Besides appearing on television for support of homeless animals, Jones wrote a regular column in the Nonpareil, which continues to be published weekly by the newspaper. Mary was a great, great pet lover, said John Liu, a former Nonpareil editor. She was super active, he said. Under Jones' leadership, Solus held fundraisers annually, including a holiday event in which people could have their pets photographed with Santa. The event was known as Santa Paws, said Liu, who served as a photographer a few years. There was always a steady stream of people with their pets, Liu said. Dady File, an animal control officer and Solus volunteer, said Jones took on the work of helping animals when the city would have been content simply to have a fundraising group. All of the sudden, we didn't have to use 10-year-old expired wormer equipment, and animals got to go to the vet, File said. Solus purchased several washers and dryers, cabinets for storage, heating pads, and formula for young animals. Things new to the world, like Capstar that kills fleas fast. We got it because of Solus, he said. File said Jones was a great person who could be ornery and loud. Her laugh could fill a room, File said. There isn't enough room to print all she and Solus accomplished. She is going to be missed, but never forgotten. A memorial service will be held Saturday at 11 a.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home in Council Bluffs. A lunch will follow at the Walnut Hill Reception Center. She'll be buried at the Omaha National Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials are directed to Solus at 1112 19th Avenue, Council Bluffs. Our next local headline reads, Iowa Western Community College music director selected to march in Macy's Thanksgiving Parade. For a music director at Iowa Western Community College, this Thanksgiving will be a special experience. Sarah Jo Amond, the college's director of instrumental music, will march in a band in the historic Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade in New York City. The band consists of 400 band directors across the United States, Amond said. The band's entry, known as Saluting America's Band Directors, will be one of the first entries when the parade gets going, said Amond, who lives in Bellevue, Nebraska. Singer Cher will open the parade, followed by the famous Snoopy balloon, she said. Then the band director's entry will follow. The band will be wearing red sports coats and navy blue pants, said Amond, who will be playing the trumpet. The purpose of marching band is to recognize the dedication and accomplishment of band directors and music education everywhere. Its theme for the parade will be America's Band Directors. We teach music, we teach life. Thursday's performance will be the band's second ever event, the first being in the Rose Bowl parade a couple of years back, Amond said. She saw them perform on television and was impressed and went through a virtual application process in the hope of joining the band in New York City. There were quite a few applicants, Amond said. It was definitely in the thousands. Her experience apparently hit just the right note when selection time came. Amond received her bachelor's degree in music education at the University of North Dakota and went on to earn a master's degree in instrumental conducting from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. She spent 3 years as the assistant band director at the University of Notre Dame, which included directing the school's marching band, jazz, concert, and pep bands. Amond came to Iowa Western this past spring. I decided I wanted to come back to the Nebraska area, and the Iowa Western position became open, she said. That was also around the time she received word that her application for the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade was successful. I was excited and quite shocked, she said. I wasn't expecting it, that's for sure. Amond was to fly into New York on Sunday with the band's first rehearsal that evening. Besides marching in the parade, the band will be playing for memorials and wreath layings at Ground Zero, the National September 11th Memorial and Museum, and the National 9/11 Pentagon Memorial. They will also see a performance of the world-famous Radio City Rockettes. As one might expect, getting all the parade participants organized can be a time-consuming endeavor. We're expected to line up at 1 a.m., Amond said. It will be a long morning. But that morning will mark a long-time dream fulfilled. It's a bucket list item being checked off, she said. The 97th Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade will begin 30 minutes earlier at 8:30 a.m. Central and will be broadcast on NBC and live-streamed on Peacock. The network will also air an encore presentation in the early afternoon. And next we have this headline of regional interest. Taylor found guilty on all 52 counts of voter fraud. The dateline is Sioux City. With verdicts for 52 charges marked in a thick packet before him, Chief U.S. District Judge Leonard Strand could have announced the verdict for each charge one by one. Instead, he shortened the suspense, telling those gathered in the courtroom to hear the verdict in Kim Taylor's voter fraud trial that he'd summarize the jury's decision. It didn't take long. After roughly 6 hours of deliberations, the jury on Tuesday found Taylor, the wife of Republican Woodbury County Supervisor Jeremy Taylor, guilty on all 52 charges, 26 counts of providing false information in registering and voting, 3 counts of fraudulent registration, and 23 counts of fraudulent voting. During the 2020 primary and general elections, Taylor, a Vietnam native, approached numerous Vietnamese voters with limited English comprehension and filled out and signed election forms and ballots on behalf of them and their English-speaking children. It was all part of a scheme, government prosecutors said throughout the six-day trial, to stuff the ballot box for her husband, who ran unsuccessfully for the Republican nomination for a U.S. House seat in the 2020 primary before winning election to the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors that fall. No one testified to seeing Kim Taylor personally sign any of the documents, but her presence in each voter's home when the forms were filled out was the common thread throughout the case. "We were definitely confident in the evidence we put forward. We are delighted, to say the least," Assistant U.S. Attorney Ron Timmons, one of three prosecutors who presented the federal government's case, said of the verdict. Jeremy Taylor, who met his wife while teaching in Vietnam, has not been charged, but has been named as an unindicted co-conspirator. The case remains under investigation, and Timmons said he couldn't comment on any potential future indictments. Kim and Jeremy Taylor, neither of whom showed a visible reaction upon hearing the verdict, quickly left the courthouse afterward. "Now is a time for empathy for a family that is suffering," Kim Taylor's attorney, F. Montgomery Brown, said. "This is how we solve controversies in America, with a jury, not with violence. We respect the jury's verdict and appreciate the jury's service. We'll move on to sentencing and try to get the best outcome at sentencing and assess any appellate decisions after sentencing," he said. Taylor faces up to 5 years in prison on each charge. Prosecutors did not request she be detained, so Strand ordered she will remain free on release until sentencing, which will be scheduled after the U.S. Probation Office completes a pre-sentence investigation. She was ordered to surrender her passport at the time of her arrest and prohibited from applying for a new one. She has 14 days to file a request for a new trial. Brown likely will renew his motion for a judgment of acquittal, and Strand, who previously reserved ruling on it, asked Brown and the prosecution to file written briefs on the matter. Taylor committed fraud on a scale rarely seen, prosecutors said. Most voter fraud cases involve one voter casting a single ballot in another person's name, said Assistant U.S. Attorney Richard Evans, who helped prosecute Taylor's case. "Despite what's in the media, voter fraud is extremely rare," Evans said. "To have someone vote dozens of times for several people, that is rare." Woodbury County election officials became aware of possible voter fraud in September 2020, when two Iowa State University students from Sioux City requested absentee ballots, only to learn ballots had already been cast in their name. They were allowed to withdraw those ballots and cast their own, but Woodbury County Auditor Pat Gill, who is also Election Commissioner, kept the fraudulent ballots. When processing absentee ballots on election night, election workers notified Gill the handwriting on a number of them appeared to be similar. After the election, Gill notified the FBI, which launched an investigation. Taylor was indicted and arrested in January. At trial, five voters who had immigrated from Vietnam and speak very little English testified through a translator that Taylor had frequently visited their homes to help them fill out voter registration forms, absentee request forms, and absentee ballots for them, and told them they could complete and sign forms for their children without their consent. One man said he handed all the blank forms to Taylor, who would leave with them. Eight young adults, the sons and daughters and a granddaughter of those five witnesses, who all were born in Sioux City and speak English, each testified they had never given consent for their parents to fill out election forms for them, and all were unaware they had done so. Many of them said they had never voted. In one case, two of the men hadn't lived in Sioux City for several years, yet voter registration forms, absentee requests, and ballots bearing their mother's Sioux City address were filed in their names. None of the witnesses, however, ever saw Taylor, who did not testify at trial, sign any of the documents, they said when Brown cross-examined them for the defense. In his closing argument to the jury, Brown said the government had presented no evidence of Taylor's guilt, and the FBI hadn't bothered to have handwriting experts examine the documents to determine if Taylor had indeed signed them. The government countered that Taylor had met with all the families who testified, had helped them fill out papers, collected them, and dropped them off at the courthouse to be processed. The evidence pointed in the direction of Kim Taylor, Timmons said. Our next headline reads, Nebraska police officer from Glenwood remembered for efforts in communities. A Glenwood community member who served as a police officer in a metro area police department died unexpectedly Saturday after a medical emergency. Christopher Abbott had just turned 48 and spent 22 years working for the Bellevue Police Department. A statement from the city of Bellevue described Abbott as heavily involved in the Bellevue community, including the recent Old Town Trick or Treat, Holiday Heroes Chili Cook-Off, and Nebraska's official Veterans Day Parade. As busy as he was, there was no doubt that his family and friends meant the world to him, and he was beyond proud of all of them, according to the statement. He was truly one of the best and an absolute go-to guy in the community, who touched more lives than he ever knew. To say he will be greatly missed in this community seems like a huge understatement. Abbott was a member of the Glenwood Fraternal Order of Eagles, number 3784, and an active volunteer for the Glenwood Baseball Softball Club. In a Facebook post, the club said many didn't see what he did, quote, in the dark, when nobody saw the work. He never sought credit, but focused on what he could do to improve the situation for our youth. Abbott started as a road patrol officer in the Bellevue Police Department before joining its Special Services Unit, where he practiced community policing since 2009. The department said in a statement that during Abbott's off hours, he enjoyed cheering for the Iowa State Cyclones and attending the College World Series. Officer Abbott was known for being hardworking, always willing to help anyone, and a dedicated husband, father, and friend, the department said. But most importantly, he loved being a dad to his two sons and a husband to his high school sweetheart. A public visitation is planned from 5 to 8 p.m. Monday, and a memorial service will be held 10:30 a.m. Tuesday at the Bellevue Christian Center. A procession to the Glenwood Cemetery will follow the service. The Bellevue Public Safety Foundation set up a fund to support Abbott's family. Donations can be made to bellevuepublicsafety.com/OFC-Christopher-Abbott. There is also a memorial set up through the Omaha Police Credit Union. Abbott is survived by his wife of 24 years, Amy, and their sons Gavin and Brecken, along with his mother, Ruth Abbott, and brother, Andy Abbott. Our next headline reads, U.S. Senator Tom Harkin to appear at Iowa Representative Josh Turek fundraiser on November 30th. A Democratic Party fundraiser in support of State Representative Josh Turek will feature an appearance from former U.S. Senator Tom Harkin. The event, set for 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Thursday, November 30th, at the Hoff Family Arts and Cultural Center, located at 1001 South 6th Street, also features State Representatives Austin Bate of Des Moines and Sammy Sheets of Cedar Rapids. Reservations for the fundraiser are requested by November 25th. Find details or RSVP at bit.ly bit.ly/Turek2023. And you are listening to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, November 22nd on IRIS, Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First, we remember Robert Bryant. On the evening of Thursday, November 16th, Robert, or Bob, Walter Bryant, age 80, passed away peacefully, surrounded by family and friends in Bellevue, Nebraska. A viewing will take place from 6 to 8 p.m. on Friday, November 24th at the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home and Crematory, located at 545 Willow Avenue in Council Bluffs. A funeral service will take place at 1 p.m. on Saturday, November 25th, also at the funeral home. Next, we remember Dennis Kaufman. Dennis R. Kaufman, age 86, of Council Bluffs, passed away October 16th at CHI Mercy Hospital. Graveside services and a burial for Dennis will be held today, Wednesday, November 22nd at 2 p.m. in Memorial Park Cemetery. Military rites will be tendered by the Canesville Honor Guard, family and friends to meet at the cemetery. And next, we remember Mary Jones, who we previously reported about. Mary Jones, age 76, passed away November 18th in Missouri Valley. Again, memorial services for Mary will be Saturday at 11 a.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Luncheon will follow at the Walnut Hill Reception Center. Mary and her husband, Michael, will be buried at the Omaha National Cemetery. Memorials are preferred to Solus, located at 1112 19th Avenue in Council Bluffs. And now turning to Dear Abby. Abby responds to three letters today. The first letter has a headline that reads, "Teens' wardrobe choices are too much for one mom." They write, "Dear Abby, I'm a fairly laid-back mom of a wonderful 13-year-old daughter. Her friends are nice kids, but some of them dress pretty provocatively. I have seen them wear super short shorts that are very, quote, cheeky, and tops that really expose their assets. We have been invited to a party at a friend's home, and my daughter is allowed to bring a friend. The friend she has chosen to invite regularly dresses in very provocative attire, and I would feel more comfortable if she knew, or rather if I knew, she was going to dress appropriately by my standards. I don't know what to do. Should I talk to the parents? Cringe. Ask my daughter to tell her friend what the dress code is and to convey wear something that doesn't show your butt cheeks? Or must I ignore it and hope for the best?" And it's signed Overexposed in Washington, D.C. And Abby responds, "Dear Overexposed, many teenage girls let it all hang out in an effort to attract attention. I do not think you should talk to the girl's mother because I don't think your comments would be warmly welcomed. Instead, ask your daughter to talk to her friend and suggest that for this occasion, it would be better to cover up more than she usually does because the hosts are old-fashioned and can be judgmental, just like you." Abby's second letter has a headline that reads, "Man has waged long fight for mental health." They write, "Dear Abby, I am a 45-year-old male who has been trying for a long time to change my attitude. I'm a really nice person when things are going well, but when things get tough, I turn nasty. I talk to myself some mornings about reacting better to situations, but then I react as I always do when things are hard. I found out 4 years ago that I am bipolar, but I don't want to use this as an excuse. I also quit weed 3 years ago in the hope that things would stabilize in my life, which has helped a lot. I used to get panic attacks, which stopped when I quit weed. Still, I don't like the way I treat people when my mood is down. I don't have the means for therapy, so that is not an option. Do you have any advice for me? And it's signed, Meanie in Florida. And Abby replies, Dear Meanie, be glad you have pinpointed what your problem actually is. I hope you are receiving treatment for your bipolar disorder. However, if you are not, then your next step should be to find a nearby college or university that has a department of psychology and talk to a professor there about what low-cost mental health services they may be able to provide. If this is not an option, inquire at your county's Department of Mental Health. You may be surprised to find that help is available on a sliding fee scale. I wish you luck in your search. And Abby's final letter today has a headline that reads, Happy Thanksgiving. And she writes, Dear readers, tomorrow is Thanksgiving, and no Thanksgiving would be complete without sharing the traditional prayer penned by my dear late mother. It reads, O Heavenly Father, we thank Thee for food and remember the hungry. We thank Thee for health and remember the sick. We thank Thee for friends and remember the friendless. We thank Thee for freedom and remember the enslaved. May these remembrances stir us to service, that Thy gifts to us may be used for others. Amen. Have a happy and safe celebration, everyone. Love, Abby. And now turning to some local education news. This headline reads, Local High School Robotics Teams Off to a Lightning Fast Start. On an unseasonably warm mid-November afternoon, members of the St. Albert High School robotics team, Thunderstruck, were hard at work tweaking their robot and honing their operating skills for the upcoming weekend's match. Students flitted in and out of the robotics lab, where the 11-member team has set up shop. A few students are gathered around a pair of gaming controllers as they familiarize themselves with the twitchy robot named Cumberbot after actor Benedict Cumberbatch, sitting inside a 12-square-foot playing field bestrewn with obstacles. The students are attempting to move the robot across the playing field without it getting stuck beneath the trusses that sit midfield. A couple of other students are huddled in a corner of the room where they tinker with another robot, Watson, so named for more Sherlock Holmes sidekick than the Jeopardy-playing IBM computer. Watson will have a different configuration than Cumberbot for a different style of game play. My favorite part is building the robots, said senior Olivia Gardner. We came up with a new idea for Watson. We're going to have like a spinning intake, and it's going to suck up two of the pixels, and then we're just going to spit them out over there. The gameplay itself is not as important as how the students work together to achieve the goal, whether it's stacking plastic cones on top of one another or fitting a six-sided plastic disc, a pixel, onto a board. The higher you can stack them, the more points you get. In addition to scoring points during the match, teams are also judged on what tournament organizer first calls gracious professionalism, which it defines as a way of doing things that encourages high-quality work, emphasizes the value of others, and respects individuals and the community. So not only does their robot have to perform well under pressure, so do the students. Communication, teamwork, Okay, let's try that sentence again. Communication, teamwork, and sportsmanship are all key skills that students come away with, regardless of what profession they choose to pursue after graduation. Gardner and fellow senior Lily Barnes are the only two girls on the team, and both have been participating in first competitions since fourth grade, initially in Lego League and now in the Tech Challenge. Ever since fourth grade, we've been able to compete, and the game changes a little. Every year, it's different. But then from LEGO League to this first tech challenge, it's a big difference, Gardner said. Gardner's father, Lynn, and Barnes' mother, Andrea, are the team coaches. In the three tournaments Thunderstruck has played in so far this year, the team has won 11 of 17 matches, good enough to be tied for second place in its league. The team hopes to top their best finish, which was 12th place in last year's state championship in the 8 years the team has existed. The five Thomas Jefferson High School robotics teams are also off to a great start in their VEX Robotics League. With four tournaments under their belt, two Thomas Jefferson teams have come in second. One has won the design award, and another team won the judges award. There are 25 students at Thomas Jefferson who participate in its robotics program, which is why they've split up into so many teams. TJ Robotics coach Shannon Dunlap has been pleased to see a lot of growth on the school teams between each tournament, not only in the students' programming or operating skills, but in social skills as well. The biggest goal of robotics is lifelong skills, soft skills, Dunlap said. They have to interview. They have to document their entire process so they can explain, this happened poorly. We did this kind of testing to fix it. This is what we did next, or this is our goal, and we're trying to build this to make that happen, she said. Students also have to learn how to work well, not only with each other, but also with the teams from other schools. They have to work with other teams, have good conversations, and planning and strategy. So a lot of those soft skills that people don't think about. Dunlap said, when people think about robotics, they're like, oh, you're smart, you build a robot. But they also have to communicate that. Dunlap said that tournaments also present an opportunity for students who might otherwise not engage with their peers to interact with like-minded kids. Because they have to interact with the other teams, you see kids come out of their shell, she said. Kids that don't talk to anybody, all of a sudden, they're talking to everybody and interacting and trying to get information about everyone else's robots so they know who to pair with. Abraham Lincoln High School also has four VEX teams that are just getting started in tournament play. All four participated in their first tournament of the year on Saturday, November 18th. Battle in the Bluffs, it was called, with two teams, the Chefs and the Bobus Videribus, placing in the top 10. For more information about FIRST, visit firstinspires.org. For more information about VEX, visit vexrobotics.com. And now turning to some local sports headlines, we have this one that reads, Saints double up Trojans in season opener. Class 1A No. 7 St. Albert used their defense and transition game to open the season with a convincing 70-35 win over Tri-Center on Tuesday night at St. Albert Activity Center. It took us a while to get established what we were trying to do, but when the ball starts going into the basket, it makes pressing a little easier. Saints coach Dick Wettengill said, it was good to have that happen, and once we got in the flow of the game and made some buckets and got our press going, it really caused them some trouble, he said. The Saints started hot scoring the first 7 points of the game before the Trojans got on the board with a Quincy Schneckloff three. The Saints began to pull away at the front half of the second quarter with a 10-1 run to push their lead over double digits, thanks to their in-the-paint shooting that heated up, partially thanks to 8 first-half points from senior Missy Esevic, and Ava Underwood added another 7 points in the first half. We just counted on each other more and got more aggressive in getting rebounds, and it was a full team effort, Underwood said. We started forcing them into some turnovers and got our transition game going, and we just kept clicking. Underwood finished the game with the game-high 17 points. Senior Ella Klusman scored all of her 11 points, including two early threes, which helped St. Albert to a 32-13 lead at the half. The Saints gave the Trojans more of the same in the third quarter, as an 11-3 run helped the Saints pull away further and eventually lead to the season-opening win, as four Saints players scored double digits to cruise to their first victory. "Once we got all our nerves out, we just got to playing our style of game," Lily Cron said. "We have a lot of different weapons on offense. Having four of us in the double digits makes our offense work a lot easier when it's not just one of us scoring, and I think that's a really good thing for our team that could help us go a long way." Cron finished with 14 points for the Saints, 10 of which came in the second half. Taylor Kinkel led Tri-Center with 10 points. 2 days before Thanksgiving, the Saints are thankful for their first win, as they will turn their focus to their first Hawkeye 10 opponent next week at Class 3A's 8th-ranked Harlan. "Like always, it's a season we're taking it one game at a time," Wittengull said. "We've got a big one next week at Harlan. That's where it starts for us next week, so we'll spend some time here over the holiday and get better. It's all about getting better each day, and with 20 girls out this season, from our freshmen to seniors, make our practices very competitive, and I think that's going to help us grow a lot this year." The Saints and the Cyclones will tip off on Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. in Harlan. Tri-Center will look to clinch its first win on Tuesday as they head to Logan Magnolia for a 6 p.m. game. Our next local sports headline reads, "Lewis Central fires past Underwood to tip off girls' basketball season." Key shots in key moments. Lewis Central seniors Anna Strohmeyer and Lucy Scott both hit from behind the arch when it mattered most, in a 49-31 win over Underwood in Monday's season opener. "Anytime you can hit a three like that, it's big, especially when you're struggling a little bit. It kind of gives you a kickstart," Titans head coach Chris Hannafin said. "Maybe it's a little more confidence. Not that we're lacking confidence, because we shoot the ball a lot in practice. So, you know, they've got the green light, and if they're open, they've got to put it up. So yeah, hit some big shots tonight to get us going, and everybody contributed one way or another." The Titans came into the season opener after a 14-7 finish in 2022-2023, losing to Glenwood in the Class 4A Region 8 semifinal, while Underwood was 19-5, falling short in the 2A Region 8 final. The Titans ran ahead early, finding scoring from five different sources as they pulled out to a 17-7 lead at the end of the first quarter. With an even share of wealth, Strohmeyer drained a triple as time expired in the first half to extend the Lewis Central lead to 29-15 at the break. "Our main thing is swinging the ball, reversing the ball, trying to get the defense behind so we can get open shots like that," Strohmeyer said. "And, you know, working the post, getting the ball in so they can kick it back out. So just being able to spread our offense so we can get those open shots," she said. At the break, the Titans had six players on the scoreboard, none scoring more than five. Underwood was paced by Elizabeth Jacobson with a first half high of 9 points. But at times, the Titans were able to limit the 6'3" forward by denying the ball. "Our first thing was fronting the post and making sure we have backside help," Strohmeyer said. "So I mean, all the girls down low are talking, 'Hey, I got your front end. You know, I got your help behind.' So once we see the ball being thrown into her, someone can maybe tip it up and get a hold of it. So yeah, just making sure to talk to each other." That communication will be key for the Titans, who aspire to win the Hawkeye 10 and make the state tournament. I think our goal every year is to win the conference, number one, and then to get to the state tournament, Hannafin said. That'll never change. Does that mean it's going to be easy? Absolutely not. But you know, if you don't set goals, there's no reason to do this. So our goals are high, and we'll see what happens. The well ran wry for both teams to start the second half, as they combined to shoot 0 for 10 from the field, before Underwood had a timeout with 5 minutes 9 seconds left in the third. Kinsley Ferguson drilled a triple for the Eagles to break their drought out of the timeout, while Strohmeyer hit her own as the clock ticked under 4 minutes to break the Titans' run of 9 straight misses. Lucy Scott then hit her second 3 of the game to increase the lead to 15, the largest of the game, just before a Lewis Central timeout with 2 minutes 32 seconds left in the quarter. That lead would extend to 20 with a Brooke Larson steal into a transition layup, but a 3 from Ferguson, her third of the game, cut the Lewis Central lead to 40-23, heading into the fourth. Both teams struggled early in the final quarter, but the Titans held on for a comfortable 18-point win. Lucy Scott led the way with 12 points, while Brooke Larson added 8 points, 4 steals, and a couple of assists. I thought our defense is pretty darn good, especially when we boxed out on the defensive end, Hannafin said, when we didn't give them second-chance opportunities. But you know, Larson played really hard on the defensive end, got a lot of steals, and she caused a lot of problems for teams because she anticipates so well, too, stepping through the passing lanes and doing those things. Strohmeyer finished with 7. The variety of scorers helps in a huge way. It does help a lot because it makes the other team have to know where everybody is on the court, Strohmeyer said. If we're able to get everybody the ball, everybody can score. You know, it makes the other team really think about, where's the girl I'm guarding? Who's going to score? So, you know, just being able to get everybody involved was super, super, super huge. Jacobson led the Eagles with 11 points, while Ferguson added 9. And now turning to a national headline, we have this one that reads, Biden's plan would raise salaries for Head Start teachers, but could leave fewer spots for kids. The dateline is Washington. A new plan from the Biden administration could significantly increase salaries for thousands of low-paid early childhood teachers caring for the country's poorest children, but might force some centers to reduce their enrollment. The Health and Human Services Agency proposed federal rule would require Head Start programs, which are struggling nationwide with staffing shortages, to raise teachers' salaries, to put them on par with local public school teachers, and to beef up benefits. The requirement could raise wages by as much as $10,000 for Head Start teachers over the next 7 years, the agency estimates. Early educators make poverty wages in many places, said Anna Markowitz, a University of California, Los Angeles professor who has studied Head Start turnover and wages. There are real consequences to these low wages. She said it's unfortunate we had to wait for the turnover to become a major crisis. Head Start teachers, many of whom are required to have a bachelor's degree, make about $39,000 a year on average, far less than educators with similar credentials. Head Start teacher turnover has doubled over the last decade, with the federal government estimating 1 out of every 5 Head Start teachers left their classroom last year. That's created problems for the country's youngest learners. Waitlists are ballooning and classrooms are closing. As many as 275,000 infants, toddlers, and preschoolers are on wait lists nationwide, according to the National Head Start Association. The federally funded program is designed to give free education and care to infants, toddlers, and preschoolers in locally run classrooms situated in public schools, community centers, and private daycares or preschools. Taxpayers spend about $12 billion for Head Start to serve roughly 1 million children. The number of kids in classrooms could shrink, though, if teacher salaries are raised and Congress doesn't grant more money for the program. Biden asked Congress for an additional $1 billion for Head Start this year. As a result of these necessary reforms, one potential impact could be a reduction in Head Start slots in some programs in order to ensure the quality of services delivered, the rule says. In Cincinnati, Head Start should be able to help nearly 2,000 students, but right now just over 1,500 kids are in classrooms because of staffing shortages, said Renee Daniel, Vice President for Early Childhood Education at the Cincinnati Hamilton County Community Action Agency. Daniel was jumping up and down when she read the administration's proposal to raise wages and add heartier benefits for Head Start staff. But without additional federal money, she would have to permanently cut as many as 800 seats to pay for those increases. Right now, we're suffering, and we're not serving the children anyway because we don't have the staff, Daniel said. Daniel said in recent years, teachers have left to work in the healthcare sector or at Amazon. Daniel recently raised teacher salaries to start at $21 an hour, but to match local public school teachers' salaries, pay will need to be about $33 per hour. The rule also suggests adding retirement benefits to teacher compensation, a new perk she'd have to offer. How am I going to create parity with that if I don't get any new money? She asked. Daniel said she plans to weigh in on the proposed rule, with the federal government accepting comments on the plan until January 19th. Health and Human Services is counting on Congress to provide additional money to Head Start, which is why it's giving programs until 2031 to fully up their salaries to match local teacher pay. And that concludes today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, November 22nd. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a safe and relaxing Thanksgiving.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. With half a dozen measles outbreaks currently underway in the U.S., as well as several serious international outbreaks, the news on measles vaccine from Denmark is important. Researchers conducted a nationwide study that included everyone born between 1999 and 2010. With more than 650,000 children in that group, they had more than 5 million person-years of follow-up. The Danish health system keeps excellent records on all of its citizens, including the children. Consequently, the scientists are confident that the 6,517 children diagnosed with autism during the study period are all the children who developed this condition. Children who did not receive the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, or MMR, were equally likely as vaccinated children to develop autism. The investigators conclude, the study strongly supports that MMR vaccination does not increase the risk for autism, does not trigger autism in susceptible children, and is not associated with clustering of autism cases after vaccination.
The Food and Drug Administration has just approved a completely new type of antidepressant. The nasal spray, called esketamine, is expected to help people who have not responded to standard antidepressants. It will be marketed under the brand name Spravato. This drug is chemically related to the injectable anesthetic ketamine that's been on the market since 1970 and is available generically. Although esketamine is administered as a nasal spray, people will not be permitted to purchase it for home use. They will need to use Spravato under medical supervision at a clinic or doctor's office. Some experts have challenged the FDA's approval process for esketamine. While two clinical trials demonstrated some benefit, Two others did not show that esketamine is better than placebo. Side effects of this novel antidepressant include nausea, dizziness, headache, and a feeling of dissociation.
FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb unexpectedly announced his departure from the agency this week. Experts were puzzled by his announcement since he has received high marks from the administration, industry, and even some consumer groups. Dr. Gottlieb has raised questions about teen vaping and has been an outspoken critic of pharmacy chains that sell tobacco products to minors. Some commentators speculate that these stances might be related to his abrupt departure. His explanation for the sudden departure is that he wants to spend more time with his wife and young children. Dr. Gottlieb is a survivor of Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Another week, another drug recall. Many lots of ARB blood pressure drugs, including losartan, valsartan, and irbesartan, have been recalled over the past 8 months. These medicines were contaminated with potential carcinogens known as NDMA and NDEA. Now, Hetero Labs has recalled 87 lots, and Tarrant Pharmaceuticals Limited is recalling 100 lots of losartan tablets. These pills contain an entirely new contaminant just identified as NMBA. It, too, is a suspected carcinogen. All three of these nitrosamine contaminants are apparently created as a result of the manufacturing process. FDA Commissioner Gottlieb stated, "We're making important strides at understanding how these impurities form, and we're continuing to examine if nitrosamine impurities may also arise during the manufacture of other ARB drug products. The FDA is committed to implementing measures to prevent the formation of these impurities during drug manufacturing processes in the future."
Cocoa flavonoids may have some benefit for people with multiple sclerosis, according to a small study. Previous research showed that dark chocolate rich in cocoa compounds might improve symptoms of chronic fatigue. The investigators recruited 40 people with relapsing remitting MS to drink cocoa every day for 6 weeks. 19 of them got high flavonoid cocoa, while 21 drank low flavonoid cocoa. At the end of the study, those on the high flavonoid cocoa had slightly less fatigue and could walk somewhat farther in 6 minutes than they had at the outset. They also reported less pain. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.